let's go with that. So as for a replacement for the missed recordings or the technically spoiled recordings, you know that the TTT archive holds recordings from last year as well, okay? And instead of just sitting in my office for 4 hours and talking that thing in one more time, I would very much like to refer you to this, to these old recordings, because, yeah, old, like they're only a year old, and it pretty much they pretty much cover the same topics, right? So for those that just missed the opportunity because of the spoiled recordings, once again, my apologies, and well, I'm confident that it works now. If it shouldn't, I will, yeah, as at least re-record today's session in my office. Okay, good. But let's hope the best that this highly complex idiocy works well. So, last time we began our considerations of social network analysis, right? And the first topic in social network analysis is centrality. And we talked about the intuition. What is a centrality index? We said it formalizes, in some sense, the importance of certain graph structures, and that could be edges or nodes. And we will discuss some central notions, how this might be formalized. Okay, and yeah, well, that was pretty much it. And so let's dig into the centrality measures. Okay. One thing that's important is that importance, in the sense we mean it, is intended to be based on the graph's structure only, right? So it should not be based on node profiles, at least not in that regard, okay? So in the realm of social network analysis, what you usually only exclusively focus on is the graph, right, and not the node or edge profiles. That is something we're going to cover in upcoming lectures, how to do data mining on these structures. And we might find other notions of importance there, okay? So what's the case is that what we want as a centrality index is a so-called structural index. And a structural index works on a graph or operates on a graph and is a function that maps either the nodes or the edges to a real value. And we want it to be, isomorphic ignorant in a sense. Yeah. So if you have a graph isomorphism, then the value of the structured index is supposed not to change under that isomorphism. And by isomorphism, we mean a mapping of nodes to other nodes, a bijective mapping, such that in the target graph, if an edge exists, then it must also exist in the original graph and vice versa. So that's a graph isomorphism. And, a structural index should be a function that is ignorant with respect to that isomorphism. Thus, it only depends on the structure of the graph, not on things as namings of nodes and so on, right? And via these properties, we see that the structural index induces a partial order on the nodes or edges, right? And what this implies is that the actual numeric value is only, valid on an ordinal scale. So the centrality values of nodes are not comparable across graphs, right? So if you have one network and have a person that's central with a value like 0.56, yeah, and you have another graph and the centrality of some other node is 1.8, you just cannot say that the 1.8 is more central compared to the other, because this is only valid within a graph. So we're measuring on an ordinal scale, not on an interval or ratio scale. Thus, we only have a partial order, yeah, anti-symmetric, transitive, and so on, right? Good, so that's important, right? And for those that do not remember these scales of measurement. So actually, in most cases, there are four scales of measurement. First is a nominal scale, which just allows you to compare things as equal or unequal. Next higher level of expressivity and measure scale is the ordinal scale. So that allows you to compare things. So the operators like larger than or smaller than can be applied to elements which are measured on that scale. Yeah, and then we'd have one example could be on Wikipedia an example is the intellectual quotient, yeah, so IQ, which is like measured on a with respect to a Gaussian distribution. So these things are to compare larger than or smaller than, but it's not that like the jump from 130 to 140, this 10 piece of increase in the intellectual ability is the same as the jump from 100 to 110. Because we're measuring with respect to the Gaussian distribution there. However, other axes besides the nominal and ordinal scale are interval or ratio scale, right? And in the interval scale, you're able to perform operations like plus and minus. And the typical example is the temperature measured in degrees Celsius, okay? So you can say today it is 10 degrees warmer than yesterday, okay? That is reasonable way of operating there. And the highest level is this ratio scale. And that's the typical example is measuring the temperature not in degrees Celsius, but in degrees Kelvin, right? So in Celsius, it doesn't make sense to say that 20 degrees Celsius is twice as warm as 10 degrees, right? Doesn't make sense. So on a ratio scale, you can also do multiplication operations, right? On a Kelvin scale, which has the absolute zero as the reference point, you can say that 200 degrees Kelvin is twice as warm as 100, right? So that these are the scales of measurement, and it's important to note that centrality indices are only relative indices. So you can say one is more important than the other, right? Good. Now, the first class of centrality indices that we're going to look at today is centrality indices that are based on distances and neighborhoods in the graph, okay? And what we always want to model is the equivalence or the rough equivalence of a centrality of a vertex and its reachability in that particular graph. And we already can see that within social networks, and that's the application we're after in most cases, a person is considered to be more central if he or she is better reachable by others, okay? And the simplest centrality measure that you can think of is degree centrality, okay? So the higher a degree of a node is, the more central this node is considered to be. Same applies for edges, right? And the degree is the number of nodes that this node is connected to. So in Facebook terms, the number of friends, right? And you can, if you have directed graphs, you can kind of distinguish in degrees and out degrees. And that will become important if we talk about web authorities or web hubs, right? So more sophisticated versions of PageRank would consider the difference between out degrees and in degrees. In that case, we apply that to hypertext and links, right? Good. One quite simple measure that's also based on distances in that case, and not just degrees are in a sense very primitive versions, because they do not rely on distances but on neighborhoods only. Okay, so if we want to formalize reachability, we must, in essence, talk about more indirect influences as well. And a simple measure that's based on distances in graphs is eccentricity, and the application example is facility location. Okay, so if you want to open a store, or whatever, it's a company, and the distance to your customers matters. What you want is to optimize this objective function. You want to minimize the maximal distance. Okay. Good. This is not the one. Sorry. No, that was the one. Sorry. Cool. Forget that about the stores. We're going to get to the stores later. This is about something different, okay? If you don't want to place a store somewhere, but instead you want to place an emergency unit, the difference is the following. So for a store, what you want is to minimize the sum of all distances. So you don't care if there's a single customer living far off. It's the average distance that customers might have that interests you, okay? So that's the case for the store. Now, this is a different thing, and that's the case for things like hospitals, because at a hospital, what you want is to minimize the maximal distance, because what you want is to guarantee emergency response times, okay? So it's not acceptable to say, okay, well, there's a person living in the outback, so if he or she has a heart attack, we just don't care if it takes 2 hours. I mean, he's going to die. So that's not acceptable. So this is called the minimax problem. And the store version is the mini-sum problem, which we're going to get to in a few minutes, right? So this is the minimax thing, okay? And it is clear that, in a sense, this can be mapped to the social case. So you're looking for persons that have whose minimal distance, for which the minimum of the maximal distance to others is minimized. Okay. For example, if you want to have a person that is a coordinator in a social network, you want to have the construction that the maximal distance to some other person should be minimized. So he or she should be central. So for the moment, what we assume is an undirected and unweighted graph, so the typical handshake-based friendship graph of social networking platforms. And these things can be mapped to the weighted case if desired. So, defining a measure, the eccentricity is the maximum of the distances of some node in question, in this case the node U, to other nodes in the graph, and V, as always, denotes the set of nodes. Okay. Now, we saw that what we want is to minimize eccentricity. So, from the semantics of that word, you see that a node is very eccentric if it's at the periphery of the graph. Now, the resulting centrality measure then must kind of reverse that eccentricity, or mathematically 1 over the eccentricity in that case. Okay, and we define the center of a graph as the set of all nodes that have minimum eccentricity, and that makes sense. Okay, so these are at the center. Now, one thing that is maybe clear to most of you, but I want to stress, is that what we see down here is a graph drawing, okay? And what we must not confuse is that the drawing is the graph, right? So the graph is something abstract, and it has an abstract topology, and a drawing can mislead you, okay? Because if you do... So this is a planar graph, right? So planar graphs are easy to draw and don't have so many chances to kind of mislead you. However, what I can do, for example, is draw things like that, yeah? And I'm doing a clique here, and I'm drawing things like that, yeah? And then I will do the other connections in that fashion, okay? Now, I think I left some of these, right? So this should also be connected to this, and this should also be connected. Yeah, well, this is already good. But what this drawing suggests to you is that there are somehow two groups, right? But in essence, what you just drew is a complete graph, right? I don't know if I missed some of the edges, but in essence, this is just a thing that you could have drawn like this as well. So 8 nodes, and each one is connected to each other, right? So that's essentially an ugly drawing, right? But that's the same. So this one suggests the presence of two groups, this one doesn't. So don't be misled by drawings of graphs. If you have a graph with like 100 nodes, and we assume that this is a social network, we will see in later lectures that it is very densely connected. And what you usually do in these cases is force-based layout, and force-based layout just assumes, as it says, spring forces between the nodes, and it can happen that nodes that are actually connected by an edge with a high weight land up somewhere in the drawing very far apart. This is not very probable, but it can happen. So we just have to distinguish the embedding of the graph from the graph itself, right? Going back to centrality and eccentricity, in that example, we denoted the respective eccentricity values. So for this node, it is 3, for this node, 4. And we see that this kind of formalizes our notion of something eccentric. And the gray ones are the center of the graph. Both have an equal value, so the resulting centrality is also the same, right? So that's a simple distance-based centrality measure. Now, going back to the store case, if you don't want to minimize the maximal distance, but want to minimize the sum of distances, you'd end up at the so-called mini-sum problem. Okay, so what we want to find is nodes that have a minimal summed up distance to other nodes. Okay, and that's interesting if you want to locate a store, for example, as I said, because you don't care about single outliers. Okay. And so if we just compute that value here, so the sum for a node u, sum up the distances to all other nodes in the graph, we'd end up with these values here in that example. And what we already see is that 1 over this is another measure, okay, that could be taken as a centrality measure, right? So the resulting centrality index in this case is called closeness centrality. Okay, so we had eccentricity, now this thing is called closeness. Okay, if you sum the distances, this is what results. Now you might say, okay, good, what I grasped is that this is another measure of eccentricity, or I shouldn't say that, of lying at the edge of the graph, right? Eccentricity is reserved for the other one. But instead of taking 1 over, what you can also do is you can take the maximum and subtract these values. Okay, that's also possible. So in this case, that's just the second implementation of the same idea, in a sense. And by this large delta G, we mean the diameter of the graph. So the diameter of the graph is the maximum distance in the graph, actually. And so in this case, we just have this plus 1 for normalization issues. Yeah. So if the distances are comparable, the distance from u to v is comparable to this diameter for all the nodes, then we see that u must be really at the fringe of the edge. So this one, this numerator becomes very small, right? That's just the math intuition. Either 1 over or max minus. That's how you do it. Okay. Now, one interesting point is that if some of the nodes are unreachable, via some directed or undirected path, we're going to have a problem, right? Because the distances are infinite, okay? And at least in that case, it becomes immediately clear that 1 over infinity, or, yeah, if 1 over infinity is not so much a problem, because then we would have 0, but if the graph contains unreachable nodes, right, we would run into problems, okay? Now, these problems are dealt with 2 other measures that I'm not going to go into more in depth, and these are based on the respective background reading. So one word on the background reading, as I said, for those that were not present, this part of the lecture is based on the network analysis book by Brandes. At least Brandes was the editor, and what we take out is 1 chapter as a background reading. Yeah, so this is available as an e-text via the library, and I'm going to link to that on the Piazza page. Right, good. Another thing that's also based on that store idea is centroids, okay? And let's assume you have 2 competitors and both want to open a store whose business model is somehow related to distance. And by that, we kind of associate the geographic distance on the planet with the distance on the graph, right? So in case you must go to the toilet, please go use the upper door, okay? So, good. So we have these 2 customers, and the question is, what kind of location would they choose, okay? And so let's denote by gamma U of V the number of vertices that are closer to U, the subscript that's down here, than to V, okay? Now, If we regard this as a game and let one of the salesmen choose her location first, let's assume we let you choose her location first, and then the other one selects his location V. The question is, what is the share of customers, if it solely relies on distance, what is the share of customers that you will have? Okay. Now, certainly, he or she will have the nodes that are closer to him than to the others. And of those nodes that are as far away from U as to V, he would have half of the customers. That's what we assume, okay? And so this formula just denotes that, because we subtract from the number of nodes those that are, closer to U or closer to V, so they're definitely closer to one of those, and that just gives us the number of nodes that are as far away from U as from V, okay? And if you analyze that, you would get this, okay? Now, the competitor of U would want to minimize this term, right? Because that's the share of customers that U gets. And V, the only way of V acting on that is by choosing a different location, right? Different location V. So this is the term that V needs to minimize, actually, okay? So going back to the first salesman, he knows all of that. So he knows what will happen, what V will choose. So he knows the strategy of his competitor. And what he does is he calculates for each possible location of his first choice, he calculates this minimum of this expression already, right? And, and that is something that can be used for constructing centrality measures, right? Because that C of U we would call a centroid value. And as you might have read, it measures the advantage that location U has compared to other location, right? So if the first one chooses U, he chooses a minimal loss of customers via the other one choosing V as to minimize the expression. Okay, so if he already minimizes this expression in with respect to his choice, U, right, then the other one wouldn't have as much freedom to counteract his choice, right? So that is the centroid value and the resulting centrality measure. In that case, is the centroid value itself. So for this example graph here, the values are as such. And what you can already see is that in this case, we have negative centrality values, except for one node, and that's the one that has the highest centroid-based centrality. Yeah. So what you should do is, in order to kind of memorize or analyze these definitions, is take the example graphs and try to calculate the numbers, and then you would really get an insight on how these things work. Okay. Now we're getting to a practically a way more important way to calculate centralities, and that's centralities with respect to shortest paths. Now, what we had was things, centrality indices based on neighborhoods. The example was degree centrality, and then based on distances. Yeah? But, distances are obviously computed with respect to shortest paths, but you can be a bit more refined than that, because there may be more than one shortest path. And it's not only about the length of this path, which is the distance, but also on the number of these paths. So if one is well connected, what we can also associate with that is that he or she has very many shortest paths to other nodes, or is on very many shortest paths containing some nodes. Okay. So the distance-based measures would just take one node, calculate the distances with some algorithm, and then do statistics on that. And in case of shortest paths, you're doing statistics on the number of shortest paths that contain a certain node. Yeah, and that's a bit of a different way to view it. That's a bit more refined and a bit more intelligent. Okay. As all the indices in that lecture, we can also apply that to weighted graphs. Yeah, but we can also do it on unweighted, directed, undirected, whatever you want. It just works with all of them. Now, what we need to assume in order to be able to reason about shortest paths and the number of nodes that they contain, or the number of shortest paths, I should say, that contain me as a node, for example, we need to compute them. Yeah, so that's the well-known all pairs shortest path problem that you might have come across in GAD, right? And what we can, for example, use is Floyd-Warshall, which has the disadvantage that it needs a cubic time in the number of nodes. And the choice of the all-pairs shortest path problem really severely depends on the nature of your weights. Now, if you only have unit weights, meaning that you don't have any weights at all, just the edges, what you can do is use simple breadth first search, right? The other class is positive weights only, and then you can gradually become more complicated by also having negative weights. And the most complicated situation is if you have positive or negative cycles. Okay, so I listed some of those algorithms that you might have come across during your basic studies. So breadth first search, solves the single single shortest path problem. And we have this typical O of V plus E complexity, but this is only applicable if the edge weights are unit, right? Dijkstra uses a bit it takes a bit longer. So V log V plus E. If you use intelligent bookkeeping data structures like Fibonacci heaps, and that allows you to efficiently calculate the all pairs shortest path problem, or at least you can use it for that in this complexity for positive edge weights. However, classical Dijkstra is single source shortest path, and in the GAD lecture you would find that it's a bit naive to use that n times or v times. Okay, there's better solutions like, and this dynamic programming approach, Floyd Warshall, which just compares each current distance by considering new intermediate nodes all the time, works on arbitrary weights, so you can also have negative weights. But what you need to have is you need to avoid negative cycles. Yeah, so these you must assume not to be present in the graph. However, luckily enough, if you apply Floyd Warshall, you can detect from the result whether the graph contained negative nodes, which in case you need to run other algorithms, right? And Bellman-Ford, again, arbitrary weights, single source shortest path with a different time complexity, okay? And if you want to just look at those, I recommend you to look at the GAD slides by Hanyo, okay? Now, the simplest centrality index that you can imagine that works with these shortest path statistics is called stress centrality. And sorry, I should put out the light, right? This is not very well readable. That's better. Yeah, sorry, should have done that first. Good. So stress centrality has the heuristic that if a vertex is element of many shortest paths, then we would assume that much information runs through it. If we assume a social network and messages flowing along the paths in the graph, and also assuming that you would have a preference for short paths, right? And if you remember what I told you about the Milgram experiment, that is more or less what Milgram just sampled, okay? And the social analog is people that work, for example, in a company, and a workflow just goes through them along the paths, okay? And it's clear that the more such shortest paths run through a node, the more central it is. So sigma AB of V is the number of shortest paths from A to B running through V, okay? And so the stress centrality of V then can be computed by averaging over all possible pairs A and B, right? So for all the possible workflows running from one node to another, what we want is that on average, V should be in as much shortest paths as possible, right? And that's stress centrality, and it's rather simple. And if you want to do it for edges, just replace the nodes by the edges. So that's not a big thing. An even more refined centrality index is called shortest path betweenness. And the reason why this is a slight modification came up is the following. So assume that you have two nodes A and B, and this node V that interests you is somewhere in between. Yeah, A, B, V is in between. Okay. Now, it's not only interesting on how many shortest paths from A to B V actually is, but it's also interesting to know what the proportion of shortest paths that actually contain V to the total number of shortest paths from A to B actually is. Well, let's assume there are five shortest paths from A to B, and V is only in one of them, yeah, or two. Then the idea would be that at least 1/5 or a higher proportion of the workflow runs through other shortest paths which do not contain V. Yeah? So the stress centrality just counts the number of shortest paths, in this case one or two, right? But does completely neglect the 5. That's also an interesting quantity to know. So what you do is you just compute the proportion. So delta AB is the proportion of shortest paths from A to B that actually contain V. Yeah? So if one path contains V and there is a total number of 5, it will be 1/5. Okay? And the interpretation is that this is the probability that V is actually involved in a communication or workflow. Good. As you might have guessed, so shortest path between the centrality is just made or won by just averaging over all possible A to B stations. Yeah? Good. And Ulrich Brandes, the editor of the network analysis book, who's a professor at Konstanz University, came up with an efficient algorithm for computing this shortest path between a centrality. And that's a very clever algorithm that has a comparatively manageable complexity, right? So even for medium-sized graphs, like whatever, 100,000, it is possible to compute the shortest path between this, okay? And there are other ways to kind of relax that, but we would not go into that, okay? So, and you might ask yourself, so what's the consequence? Okay, but just taking that proportion. So let's look at this example here, right? So in the upper example, we have this special graph here, tripartite graph. And if you compute the centrality values for the gray nodes, what we see is that the stress centrality for all of them is 28, right? And that's because of the connection structure that we have here, this tripartite connection structure. So we have 8/2 possible choices here, right? So that's why we get 28. And if you compute the shortest path between this, what you get is 1/3 for all of them, okay? So for the moment being, this is not a proof because we know that centralities are only ordinally interpretable, right? So the actual absolute value doesn't tell us anything. But compared to the lower graph, still this gray node, this now single gray node, has a stress centrality of 28, while it has a shortest path between the centrality of 1, right? Because it is on all shortest paths that contain each of those white nodes that can be imagined. So it's essential. And what we see is that shortest path between us captures this idea of importance way better than the stress centrality itself. Okay? Because our intuition tells us in the upper example, each of the gray nodes should be about 1/3 important, whereas in the lower case, the single node at the center should have a three times higher importance than any of those here, which shortest path between us actually does capture. And the reason is that we would use this proportion instead of the total number. Okay, good. Good. Now, for edges, it's just the same analog, so no real news here. You may ask yourself, okay, good. Shortest paths are a bit harsh, right? Because communication does not flow along shortest paths only. And that's a critique we're going to follow in more depth in a few minutes, right? So instead of doing statistics on the set of shortest paths, you might as well do statistics on all paths, as well as the set of k shortest paths. So a k shortest path is a path that is not longer than k. And this is especially interesting for our social case. Why? Because we already know that in social networks, everybody appears to know everybody else over six edges, right? So three edges is already something that's really far away. Like, it's the friend of a friend of a friend. And our social intuition already tells us that, well, a path length of three in terms of edges, if you count edges, right? It's not usable. So the things that are usable are really only one or two in essence. Yeah? So it makes sense to limit that to that, okay? And instead of just counting the set of, or using the set of k-shortest paths, we might also add the desirable property that we just want to regard node disjoint paths to do our statistics, because we say that if we keep on reusing the same sub-elements in our path over and over, we're also, yeah, like over-counting in a sense, yeah? And what you can also do is to allow an epsilon deviation on the actual distance because of stability reasons, yeah? So these quantities have the problem that they're not really in all cases stable if you remove nodes or edges. So they might undergo, non-continuous changes. Yeah? And that's why you want to relax your distance and allow something like an epsilon deviation here, because that would allow you to get a more stable centrality index, okay? And that's especially important if you regard mobile social networks social contexts of a shorter duration, like social situations or short-term encounters, because in those networks, well, connections, edges keep on appearing and disappearing in very short time intervals, like half an hour or so, while the friendship networks are much more stable in terms of time, right? So that's something you might want there, okay? So another question that you might pose is, how can we derive edge centralities from node centralities? In a sense, these things must be somehow connected, and can we try to come up with something like that? Okay. And what we might be tempted to do is that while we're giving the original graph, we might be tempted to construct something that's called the edge graph. And that's just a graph that is defined by taking the original edges as nodes and the nodes as edges, right? And if you have your centrality measure based on nodes only, you might be tempted to actually construct the edge graph and then apply the same methods on the edge graph in order to derive edge-based centralities, okay? Now, the difficulty is, for the first aspect, that this G prime, this edge graph, may be quadratically larger than the original graph. Why is that? Because the number of edges for a dense graph is O of n squared, right? And so that's already a problem, because if you have a network with 10,000 nodes, the edge graph already has 10 to the 10 many nodes, which might be a bit too hard for most of the algorithms that we introduce here. Yeah. So another thing is with weights, right? So in social networking, we have a clear intuition what a weight on edge might mean. Although we would see that there's lots of ways to calculate social weights. Yeah? And Gilbert and Kahelios wrote a paper at CHI several years ago who they try to formalize ways to come up with high strengths based on social media interactions. Yeah? For example, you can count the frequency of, or the relative frequency of messages. You can do statistics on the length of messages or on the temporal sequence, yeah, and assume certain things, right? And so, but we don't have an intuition what a weighted node actually might be. Yeah? So that's the first drawback. And the second drawback is that you cannot preserve your original intuition about the node centralities if you just use the edge graph. Yeah? And if you have, you have an example here. So that's the original graph. And the corresponding edge graph would be something like that, right? And while this node, in a sense, is central, how do we find that intuition here? So it doesn't make sense, right? And the thing that you can do is you can construct this so-called incidence graph where we split each original edge and add new edge vertices here, right? And what we see is that these constructions are much more well suited or much better suited for our purposes than this just simple edge graph construction, okay? Good. And if you analyze this in a bit more depth, so for G, our stress centrality of any edge would be 3. Like, because every shortest path runs through one of these edges. But in G prime, the stress centrality, for example, the original edge A, which now becomes a node, is 0 because no shortest paths whatsoever run through A, right? If we exclude this node itself, which we must do, okay? So what we see is that we would better work with the incidence graph than with the edge graph. Yeah. Now, and these were measures that were based on shortest path statistics. Another way to formalize importance is to consider what happens if I take out that node or edge. Okay. So let's assume a company, and you want to find out the particular value, employee value of a certain person. How would you do that if you fire that person and measure the, well, financial outcome of your company and it severely decreases? You might conclude, oh, might not have been so good to fire that person because obviously she was important for the whole company, right? And this is precisely what vitality type of indices try to model. So you take some quality measure on the original graph, whatever your quality measure might be. Yeah, we will see examples for that. And you compute that measure on the original graph, and then you compute the measure on the graph when you took out either an edge or a node. And this difference then is called the vitality of that particular graph element X. Okay? Good. So while that may be logical, you might ask yourself, what are possible quality measures? Okay? And one possible quality measure is flow. Okay? Now, what's flow? Good. Assume your graph is, in a sense, a water pipe system, yeah? And the nodes are, in a sense, joints, and the edges depict pipes, okay? And the weight of the respective edge corresponds to the diameter of the pipe. Now, let's assume you'd have a large pipe system and you would pour in water at one edge and you would try to have a sink at some other joint. Yeah? The question is, how can you maximize the flow through the graph? Okay? And, a flow is like a function that takes two nodes and computes the the maximum flow that is compatible with these constraints. And the constraints are that the flow that actually flows through such a pipe must be smaller or equal than the capacity. So you cannot put more water through a pipe than maximum diameter. Okay. However, it can be, you can let a smaller amount of water flow through that. If that maximizes the total flow, you're fine. Okay. And the second constraint is balance conditions. So at each of these joints, at each of these points, what you must have is that the flow that corresponds to flowing out of V must be the same as the stuff that flows into V. Yeah, so that's a conservation law, because you just cannot store something at the nodes. What must come in must also go out, and naturally that doesn't apply to the source and the sink. Right, because at the source you pour something in, and at the sink you take out something. Okay, and the actual definition of the flow is that if you count all the out edges of S, right, this is the actual maximum flow that you can achieve, right? And this is also the same as the in edges of T. And there's a mistake in the actual paper, because in the paper it says has a minus here, which is not true, right? So this is the correct definition of a flow, right? And a flow is just a mapping in that sense. And what you might ask yourself is, what is the actual maximum flow? Yeah? So what you can do is you can tweak these local flows, make them smaller or bigger, and then try to maximize F itself, okay? And that is called the max flow that you can achieve in a graph, right? And that you can compute by this algorithm by Goldberg and Tayan in that complexity here, yeah? So that's comparatively manageable, okay? And our quality measure would just be the maximum flow averaged over all possible sources and sinks, okay? Now, that is, in a sense, something that maps the quality, as I said, of the whole graph, because we average over all possible sinks and sources, and that is the quantity that we want to use for this vitality type of index. Yeah, we want to compute these flows, these maximum flows, while X, an edge or a node, is still present, and then we do the same computation when we take out a node, and then see what happens, okay? If this node was important in a sense of flow, what happens is just that taking out would affect these statistics severely, okay? Because then the max flow that is achievable would just be decreased, yeah? And the social analog would be also something like a workflow, yeah? If you take out a certain person and the company just can only produce half as many goods as before, you know this was a really important person, okay? Good, so that's how you can do it here, okay? And we can also take over this betweenness idea that we had with shortest path betweenness, and we can set the gain or loss in proportion to the actual value, in this case, of the quality measure, right? And what you get is max flow betweenness. Yeah, it's just the analog of what happened at the with the shortest path statistics, okay? And so this numerator here just formalizes the amount of flow that U is responsible for if you take out U as a note, for example, right? So this shows us how we can translate the betweenness idea here to the max flow, okay? Sorry. Another example for such a quality measure that comes from telecommunication is the Wiener index, and it's defined as the sum of all distances, pairwise distances in the graph, okay? And the motivation is that if you have a mobile communication network, each node should be connected to each other node by as few intermediaries as possible. So this whole measure that just sums up these distances should be as small as possible, okay? So the corresponding centrality, or no, the corresponding quality would be that, okay? And we can then, once again, use these vitality type of considerations. And we already know this term, because this, yeah, neglecting the first sum, this is already something that we called the closeness centrality, okay? So in essence, this quality can be written as this 1 over the closeness, okay? Because closeness was just 1 over that. And that's why we would call this thing the closeness vitality, yeah, if we use the Wiener index. Okay. Once again, possible interpretation would be the costs associated with sending a message from one person to another person. What needs to be regarded is that if we have special cases, for example, if we have two halves of the graph and just one tiny bridge connecting these two halves and one node is on the bridge, you would have a problem in many cases, because if you take out this node that forms the bridge with its edges, then the graph becomes disconnected. Yeah? So then we might have a problem, because in case of stress, for example, we might earn mathematical problems. So in this case, we would have to work out other things, okay? Good. Now, we can ask ourselves, okay, so that was once again based on distances. Can we do the same stunt with our shortest path stuff as well, yeah? And remember, we had this stress, which is, and this is really to be interpreted in the sense of the word. A person that is part of many shortest paths does have stress, because he or she is consulted all the time, right? And the question is, can we use that as a quality measure for the graph? So can we use the stress centrality as a graph quality index, right? And the idea would be, okay, before taking out a node, we'd have such an average stress, for example, yeah, for all of the nodes. And if we take it out, we might have some different stress, yeah? And the downside of using that in a naive way is that the actual number of shortest paths can actually increase when you take out an edge, for example. Yeah? And that is counterintuitive, right? Because we assume that, in a sense, a quality measure should decrease if you take out an element, like a node or an edge. But the actual number of shortest path indeed can increase if you take out something, and that's counterintuitive. But here we have an example, and if you look at both graphs, the difference is that we took out the edge E, okay? So these upper nodes are not friends anymore, okay? And in the left graph, we have 54 shortest paths, and the number of shortest paths containing that edge was actually 8, right? While in the right graph, we have 64 shortest paths, and the respective statistics are not usable for what we want. Yeah? And naturally, if you take out something, then you would lose paths in the sense of their length, okay? But in the sense of their number, you might win. So the observation is, in the right example, that 18 of these shortest paths have increased in their length. However, their statistics are favorable, their number increases, but the length does not. The length does. And they're not decreasing, right? So the solution just is that you can use stress as a vitality type of index, but you must focus or restrict yourself on those shortest paths that did not change their length. And that number can only get smaller by taking out something. Okay? And the question is just how do we denote that? Okay? And if we're interested in the stress centrality as a vitality type of index, what we compare is the stress before we take out V and then after we take out V. And in order to have that, formalize that constraint, we use this Iverson bracket here, right? So instead of having just this expression for stress that we know, yeah, we would additionally introduce that Iverson bracket, okay? And the idea of the Iverson bracket is just that within this square bracket, you have some logical expression which can either be true or false, okay? And if it's true, yeah, the value of that Iverson bracket is 1 in the case of true, and in the case of false, it'll become 0, okay? So by that, we just filter out those shortest paths that have changed their length, yeah? And in that way, we can use stress centrality as vitality as well. Yeah? Good. So, for the last 20 minutes, let's look at something slightly different. Good. Okay. What we saw was nice, shortest path between a centrality, better than stress centrality, because it formalizes our intuition a bit better. But is this idea of shortest paths really valid? Yeah. And if you look at that example that's on the slide here, what we would have is that all the shortest paths, or very many shortest paths, I should say, so there are also shortest paths within group 1 and group 2, but the shortest paths that connect group 1 and group 2 will all run through A and B. But they would never run through C, because C would just be a detour. Yeah? You would have one edge more. However, this is a bit counterintuitive, because in a sense, A, B, and C just form intermediates, like a team of intermediates that kind of mediate between those two groups. And it's not very likely that C would never be consulted in that fashion, yeah? So social pressure would take care of that C is also consulted in the workflow. But shortest path between us does not respect that in its simple form, yeah? So that's a critique that we can formulate, okay? Now, the same or a equivalent critique applies to our vitality and this max flow between the centrality that we talked about, right? So assume that you have the situation that's depicted on the right, okay? And further assume that all the edges are limited to an edge capacity of 1, yeah? So in order to be simple here, okay? So, and what we have is that the flow between those two groups is limited to 2 units, yeah? Because they would have to kind of pass through these 2 pipes, if you regard them as pipes. Or if it's from 1 to 2, they would have to pass through these 2 pipes, yeah? And since the flow in from group one or two and or the other way around is limited to two units, what we see is that max flow would, in only rarely use C, right? Because it just doesn't change anything in a sense. So although G might be even on shortest paths, the flow kind of formalization of centrality would not work in that sense that it would attribute importance to C in that case. Yeah, so C just wouldn't appear if you calculate the max flow. Okay, so that's the other critique. So shortest path betweenness or max flow betweenness is prone to these effects, to these situations, which are in a sense counterintuitive. Now, how do we deal with that? So one possibility that we will kind of come across multiple times is the idea of a random walk. So assume somebody like surfing on the web and choosing links at random. This person can be considered a random walker on the graph of web pages and links. And if we want to grasp the importance of a node, it is intuitive to say that if that node or edge is visited by a random walker or random surfer a lot more than other nodes, then this node or edge should be more central or more important. Okay? And in a sense, this random walk-based centrality is something like the opposite end of conceptualization, because shortest path betweenness assumes that information or resources have a perfect idea along which path they're going, because they're going along shortest paths. So they must have some global knowledge in a sense. While the random walk-based centrality is just about, as it says, a random surfer, a random walker, who has no intuition at all how to reach nodes or something. Yeah, you would just let him or her walk on the graph for an amount of time and then just do statistics on how many times did he or she visit node number 117, right? And the thing that we need to refine is that what we do not want to have is paths or walks, I should say. They're not paths, they're walks that have hands and forth motion, like going from A to B and B to A and A to B like five times. Can happen, but we don't want to count these, in a sense. Good. And random walk-based centrality, as we will see, can be computed in this complexity m plus n times n squared, which is not actually easy, but still at the edge of that we can manage. Okay, so it's worth regarding this in a bit more depth. Okay, now this part of the lecture is based on a small paper by Mark Newman. And I also would link this on Piazza. And Mark Newman is a physicist, actually, who produced a lot of contributions to network analysis. And he also wrote a thick book about networks that contains a lot of knowledge on these things, right? And he formulated that critique or took it up. And the paper is about a simple observation that we would like to present or that we would like to look at, okay? And this observation is that this random walk-based centrality that we saw is kind of sensible, right? Is actually the same as something that we might call current flow between the centrality, okay? Now, if you say, okay, good, you had this example of pipes and flow, right? And isn't electrical flow the same? And we will see that there are subtle differences, and the random walk-based centrality is identical to this current flow-based centrality. And why am I presenting you this? Because this current flow-based centrality is also covered in this article that we base this part of the lecture on. Yeah? So these are two articles, one in the social network analysis, in the network analysis book, and the other one by Mark Newman. Okay? And I think the treatment in Newman's paper is way more understandable than in this article. Okay? Now, assume you have an electrical network. Yeah? So you'd have wires and resistors and voltages and things like that. Okay? And with VI, we want to denote the voltage at some vertex I. Yeah? So the voltage is just the electrical potential, and the difference in electrical potential is the actual voltage that drives electrical or that motivates electrical currents to flow. Okay, so VI are the voltage values, the numerical voltage values. And still, what we want to have is we want to insert one unit of current in the network, and we want to have one unit of, want to take out one unit of current at the sink T, right? Okay, good. Now, if we would just like to compute the resulting voltages, how can we do that? Now, you might know from school or physics that these linear networks can be easily solved by applying two laws, basically, and that's Kirchhoff's point law and Kirchhoff's Maschenregel in German, loop rule, I think it's called, but we're not going to look at this, okay? So the point law is very easy to understand. So what flows into some node must flow out again, right? So the electrical currents must sum to zero, okay? Because what flows in must also flow out. And this is just the simple formalization, setting all the resistors for the moment to one. So A is the adjacency matrix, yeah? And A is 1 if there's an edge between I and J, and 0 otherwise, okay? And so this is the balance that occurs at any internal node. So for any internal node that's not S or not T, this right side is 0, okay? So that's just the formalization of what must flow in must also flow out. And naturally, only those branches have to be regarded that are actually connected, right? So this node is not connected to that, so the voltage of that doesn't play a role for this, at least not directly in terms of this point law, okay? And once again, we have the Kronecker delta, which is a symbol that's very useful for calculating, and it is 1 if the indices coincide and 0 otherwise, okay? So the goal now is to solve that electrical problem, take out the interpretation of centrality out of that, and see that the random walk-based centrality is actually really the same as this voltage-based thing. Okay? Good. Now, if you observe that if you sum the rows of the adjacency matrix for the columns, I should say, doesn't make it symmetric anyway for undirected graphs. if you sum over the columns and let one row index fixed, what you get is the degree of that vertex. Yeah? You just have to count. Okay, so if you have some matrix, and that's the adjacency matrix, and you would just regard one row I, yeah? And there are a lot of ones and zeros here, depending how this node I is connected, and you just sum them up, sorry, what you get is simply the degree of this vertex I. Okay. Now, if we insert something like a source vector, which is 1 for the source and minus 1 for the sink and has zeros otherwise, we can write this equation in that precise form if we regard D as a diagonal matrix whose elements are just the degrees. Okay? That's essentially the same, yeah, or identically the same. Yeah. How can we understand that? Okay, so we're summing over J. So VI is a constant, right? And what we see is that sum over J, AIJ, is the degree of node I. Yeah. So what we have on the diagonal is VI times this degree. And for the other, for VJ here, what we have is normal matrix multiplication. Okay, sum over J, AIJ, VJ. Okay, so these terms here from the first half would give us these elements of this diagonal matrix D, and this difference here is called the graph Laplacian, and that's something you would find in a lot of applications of social network analysis. Okay, so that's the precise equation. Now it appears as if the only thing that we need to do is to invert this matrix, and then we can solve for the voltages. Yeah, and in a sense, if you remember the pipe-like max flow stuff, you would have to solve an optimization problem. Here, you would only have to solve, or let physics do the optimization, in a sense, right? And we will see that this yields different results, which kind of avoid the problems at these critique slides, okay? Now, the problem is that the graph Laplacian, or the determinant of the graph Laplacian, is actually zero, yeah, because the vector with all ones is an eigenvector of this matrix with an eigenvalue of zero. And since the determinant is the product of the eigenvalues, we know that this matrix is singular. Yeah. And why is that? It's because this system of equations is overdetermined. And why is it overdetermined? Because physically, a potential is just measured with respect to some artificial zero, okay? Why is that? Because the actual physical quantities, so the electrical field, is computed via a derivation of the potential, so only differences in potential do physically matter. So we're having this thing overdetermined because this constant that we have in there is kind of not respected. So what we can do is we can measure our voltages with respect to one whatever node we take and set the voltage of this node to zero. So then the system of equations becomes non-singular and we can solve it. So what we essentially do is we leave out one row and the respective column of that matrix, okay? And then we can invert that, and then we can solve for the voltages, okay? And that's what we do, okay? Good, and that's what I wrote here. Laplacian is not invertible, blah, blah, blah. So we take out this column and row V. And we would later put it back again by inserting row and column with all values equal to zero. Yeah? And that corresponds to measuring the voltages with respect to that node V. And you can take any node that you want. And we would call the resulting matrix, leave out V, column, and row, and then reinsert row and column with all zeros. We will call this T. Okay? Now, as for our problem, we know that, going back here, the only node that has an incoming current is this source, and the only node that has an outflowing current, at least with respect to the total balance, is the sink T. Okay. Now, what we get is that the voltage with respect to designating S as a source and T as a sink is just the difference of those two matrix values. Okay. And that results in the fact that we can now solve for the current flow at some node I, and that's just this equation. Yeah. So this factor of 1/2 kind of models that we have something flowing in and something out at each node. Yeah. So that's more or less what you know from physics. Maybe U is R times I. Yeah. So the current flow is proportional to the voltage difference. Yeah, good. And these are the consequences, so I won't go into detail about all the math now. We can do that in tomorrow's lecture. And what we get then is this current flow between this measure for a node I. Okay. And once again, the intuition is a node is more important the more electrical current flows through it. And this is also true for the flow. Yeah, but for the max flow problem, you'd have to solve a optimization problem. Here, you would only have to solve for the physical voltages. Okay, and next time, what we're going to see is that if you formalize the random walk between this, you would get exactly the same result. Yeah, and the consequence is that we can use both, which are actually the same. And what we will then see is that if you take these examples that I presented to you in the beginning for a concrete group 1 and group 2, what we will see is that our shortest path between us and max flow between us do not perform according to our expectations, whereas our new random walk or current-based centrality actually does. Okay, so it attributes higher values to C, and that's just what we wanted. Okay, and that's, how should I put it, in a sense, a more complicated way of computing centralities, but in another sense, it's very, gives us a lot of insights about the mechanics of centrality indices, right? Now, tomorrow morning, we're going to repeat that from at least from that point, and would then finish on centralities. Okay, so for those of you that want to attend, welcome tomorrow, and for those of you that would like to sleep, I hope, and I really am convinced that we can rely on the recordings. I will triple check this. Okay, so if anything goes wrong, I promise you I would re-record it in my office. Yeah, so you're free to choose whether you want to turn up or not. Good. So for those, welcome tomorrow. The other ones I see next week.